Morning!
Morning!
Welcome to the India Explained podcast, recorded in London and San Francisco. One take, unscripted, no rehearsal.
Hey Bunty, greetings from San Francisco. It's been a few weeks since we had a chance to do a podcast because of various commitments. What's up with you, man?
It's good, Rohit. It's good to be speaking to you today. The sun is out. It's a lovely Sunday in London. It's just before the bank holiday, which is essentially the Monday is off. So it's all in all, it's really nice. I'm trying to make some teriyaki chicken with a teriyaki marinade, but I think the chicken is slightly past its sell-by date. So my wife is deeply suspicious of how it will turn out. I'm convinced that I can eat it. My wife is not going to eat it. So that is the highlight at the moment that we see.
But you're a good cook first. And I think I also really appreciate your fearlessness in experimenting. I need to, I love food. Who doesn't? Sorry, silly, banal observation. But yeah, I need to kind of up my cooking game and learn a few things. My one claim to fame was that I think about 7 years ago, from a recipe in the Wall Street Journal of all places, but it was a recipe by an Indian. Yeah. I made vada pav from scratch, boss. The vadas, everything, totally from scratch. And it came out fabulous. But as my wife reminds me, she said that, you've been coasting on that one thing for about 7-8 years now. But that's great. I hope you enjoy your teriyaki chicken. So what do you want to talk about today, man?
I think one of the things that we were doing, I'll tell you what's happening. So as I've explained to you that I started dabbling with cricket a few days back, as in I do a bit of nets, I play the odd Sunday cricket here, and it's fun. It's not competitive cricket. It's cricket played to be lost, right? That's the cricket that I play, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the connection with that cricket, one of my friends organized a nets, and in the nets session, so we were three, four guys in their late 40s or early 50s, and then he managed to invite some people who were his, some friend's son who are attending college. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And so they were in the 21, 22. So for the first time in my life, the guy said to me before bowling, say, uncle, should I bowl quickly to you or do you want to get some ball come in gently? I said, bowl easy to me. But don't call me uncle. Now the thing was, it's nothing, no harm. And he smiled and he said, yeah, don't worry. I was just thinking. But obviously, we have now reached the age where people refer to us as uncle, right? Huh. And I was thinking that when we were growing up, we had these uncle types, different types of uncle types. If you had to do an observation on the types of uncle that people have to deal with, right? What would be a starter for 10? What would be the 2 to 3 types of uncles that we would be easily able to identify? What would be their characteristics?
It's a very good point. So I think one kind of desi uncle, and we kind of did something mildly overlapping with this earlier. There's definitely the, especially in the last 7 years, I want to say a little before that, the Modi government is going nuts about its achievements over the last 7 years. So the last 8-9 years, we've seen the saffron uncle emerge, right? So that's the ultra Hindu uncle. So I think the saffron uncle is one. And then who would you say is the second one?
So as a counterpoint to the saffron uncle, there'll be Naxal uncle. Right?
Ah, take
it. Ultra leftist uncle.
Ah.
That seems like the second category of uncle.
Okay,
I think there's also another type in the middle somewhere.
So the third type is an uncle who is, it doesn't matter to him whether someone is a left-wing dictator or a right-wing dictator, but he's a guy who thinks that, boss, India needs discipline. So I think he's a fascist uncle.
Yes. That's a good categorization.
And we are using fascist historically in a slightly inaccurate sense. Because, technically, Fidel Castro was not fascist. But our definition of fascist uncle is that, boss, I don't care what your ideology is. Just get the buggers to work, That's...
Yes.
So, the thing is, and we are doing this, actually, we are doing this in the public interest, especially for Indians of younger generations, because having been through this and having now, you know, moving into uncledom oneself and hopefully not replicating this, we want to share, actually, we are doing a slightly uncle thing here, boss, because we are sharing our gyan without it being asked for. So we want to share our wisdom, like Indian uncles, about warning signs for these three very, you know, these three categories of Indian uncles. So why don't you take it with, like, for the saffron uncle, the mythological uncle or whatever.
So saffron uncle is a recent phenomenon.
Huh. Right?
What has happened is with the rise of kind of, you know, Hindu identity politics, there's a cadre of like middle-aged men who started their career. You know, so they, when they started their career, they were literally, India was liberalizing, right? And so they were mid-career when India was liberalizing. So now, after kind of Narasimha Rao's passing, they went into their power mode. Like, they really came into power. They started taking decisions. They were kind of slightly, nominally resentful of Manmohan Singh's kind of tepid tenure. And then when Modi ji comes into power, they flourish because, you know, professionally they are at a very strong point in their career arc. And one of the things that happens is as they grow older in life, they pick up an active interest in Hindu mythology. Right? So one of the things that happens is because they are operating in relatively urban circles, right? So they are not like Uttar Pradeshi thugs, right? So they are not going to go and beat up Muslims at the first opportunity. Right? They are in an evolved urban context. So they're generally going to be found in Delhi, Bangalore, Calcutta, right? And they'll be holding down responsible corporate positions. Now, in this milieu, how do you kind of juxtapose this kind of rise in your passion for a particular brand of Hinduism? The easiest expression is everything they start referencing and discussing is couched in some kind of Hindu mythology. Right? So it doesn't matter what you are saying. So suppose you're talking about, you know, I'm feeling slightly under the weather. I've been diagnosed with brain cancer. And my mood is not right. So this uncle will say, have you tried Sanjeevani? Right. So, and then you say, where are you going with this? Why Sanjeevani? I'm plugged into the best medicine. No, hang on a minute. Do you know what Sanjeevani is? So, and most of this kind of mythological referencing is the facts are fast and loose, right? So he'll riff on the fact that it's Sanjeevani, and then he'll say that, you know, Sanjeevani is available in Greater Kailash 2 market behind M Block. And I will find it for you if you do not know, because, you know, I have found the therapeutic benefits of Sanjeevani amazing. So this quick shorthand referencing to myth, and this can't be like head-on mythology references, right? So he will not fuck around with, like, you know, big gods and goddesses. Right? It will be like nominal, like, you know, Indravati's elephant. Something like you won't know the place where this guy is coming from, right? But this kind of nominal, you know, that or things. The other thing that's very popular is, have you ever been to Sri Lanka? You say no. Do you know at one point in time you could walk to Sri Lanka?
I know the Ram Setu Bridge or whatever it is.
Yeah. So then there's this underwater bridge, which on the 12th night of the 15th year, possible. So that's my mythology uncle take, that, you know, this referencing, cross-referencing to random mythology. Have you seen these people?
In droves. And, you know, then the other one is, for some reason, like, you know, this uncle, I want to locate this uncle's age. I want to say it's sort of 55 to 70 or so. All right.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe even like above. Or let's say 60. Yeah. Now, this is a person who spent a good deal of their life under the Nehruvian dispensation, right? That even if Nehru himself, you know, passed away, and when was it? 64, right? So, but the world that he spent a good chunk of his professional life in was this, you know, structured according to the principles of Nehruvian ideology. And the thing is, in his heyday, he very much believed in it and he was very much off it. Now, you know, over a lifetime, There have been professional frustrations. There have been, you know, probably some, you know, personal pitfalls. That happens to everyone. But cumulatively, post-retirement, all his irritation about everything, everything in the world, right, can be traced back to Nehru. So, roads are not working in India, Nehru's problem. Yeah. Times, England, London did like a list of the world's 100 best educational institutions. There's not a single bloody Indian one, I tell you. Nehru's to blame. Okay. Quality of Alfonso Mango has gone down. The bastard Nehru, you know. So, what's happening is that the love of, like, the idea of, like, you know, overarching Hindu identity, Nehru and secularism are suddenly to blame. So, you know, like, sort of early in the morning, like, you know, if this uncle will come to visit, let's say, all right, now, uncle is retired. So he's, you know, he's up at 4 a.m. He's been up since 4 a.m. He's, you know, I mean, internet is still something he struggles with. So he's waiting for, like, the paper copy of the Times of India to come to your house or whatever. The copy has come 5:30. Now you are maybe working or you're going to college, right? So you've woken up groggy. 5:30 in the morning or 6:30 in the morning, what do you think of Nehru? You know, like, boss, at 6:30 in the morning, I'm thinking about nothing.
No, I think you make a great point, Rohit. It's great you've placed him where you placed him in the demographic. You know, this obsession with Nehru and Nehru's errors is one thing. The other thing that I've noticed in this and in social media exchanges with these uncle types is a preference to expressing something in brief in Sanskrit, right?
Ha, 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 ha.
Before providing a robust English translation, which may have little or no bearing with the original sentiment of the phrase.
Or, you know, like, actually just thinking of the equivalent Sanskrit or Sanskritic Hindi term. And I'll share an example with you. But you really are onto something very important here. Yes.
So what they will do is, suppose you are telling us, I'm feeling this is, uncle, the rental income from, I've been charged too much rent and this is a problem. So you're talking about a very mundane thing in world, right? You know, that's happening to your day-to-day life. Uncle will listen carefully and looking into middle distance, he will say, beta, sattameva jayateva.
Yeah.
So then where is this dude coming from, right? And then he said, probably you don't understand what I'm saying. Let me break it down for you. And then he will do a complete tapori take on what that original says. So there's this thing I was doing around that everybody in India is actually Hindu.
Right?
Because the word Hindu is inhabitant of the land of Hindu.
Right? Yeah.
and this was accompanied by some kind of thing. Now, I don't know the veracity of this. Which pamphlet this has been picked up from. But I think some of this kind of Sanskrit meandering is a suspect, right?
Totally suspect, boss. And it is a way of, like, you know, falsely signaling expertise. So we actually had a professor in Bombay University, Professor Prabodh Parekh. He taught at the university level, whereas, you know, you also have professors who teach at the college level. So occasionally he would come and deliver a talk or a lecture to us at Xavier's. So he was talking about European philosophy and, you know, the roots of Western philosophy and also, like, something about deconstruction. But, you know, what he would do is he would say, Aristotle, Aristu. So I didn't understand it, but apparently Aristu is the Indian name for Aristotle. Then he would say, you know, but this idea goes back to Plato, Aflatun. So Aflatun is apparently some, like, you know, old Indian name for Plato. So then, you know, he was trying to explain surrealism, like the movement in painting and the philosophical roots. And what he was trying to do, and this is something that a lot of, like, uncles would do, is he was essentially saying that every interesting philosophical idea in the Western tradition actually was there first in the Indian tradition. So his point was that, you know, deconstruction is also there in the Indian philosophical tradition, and it may be, I don't know. So I don't want to dismiss it, but surrealism, he's saying that surrealism and Marxism also, basically you have thesis, you have antithesis, and they collide, and you have a collision, explosion, And then you have synthesis, visfort. So visfort basically means explosion or bomb. And the thing is that it was nice that he was excited, but it was completely unnecessary, you know. So it just like was very puzzling for everyone, including my poor professor, Eunice D'Souza. But anyway.
So let's look at the next uncle. We talked about Saffron uncle. Let's talk about fascist uncle.
Fascist uncle, point is that sheer force, you know, and the lack of logic. Because so fascist uncle is basically how the whole colonial mindset of governing Indians, right?
Yes.
Tum sala log ko hum, you know, apna jute ka niche rakhega. Like, there's deep admiration for the colonial sahib. So that's the first thing. And democracy is an irritant. I don't think fascist uncle understands democracy, but pure hierarchy and brute force. Like, that's basically his worldview.
I think again, just let's look at fascist uncle. Fascist uncle, right? He may not have a direct military career, right? So what he will do is he will probably dabbled in NCC, like national, some kind of voluntary paramilitary number, right? I'm not saying
basically he's grown up Boy Scout.
Grown up Boy Scout, exactly. So and he'll be partial to use of penknife. And he's going to be very, very adept at demonstrating how something, a harmless domestic object, can be used in self-defense.
Absolutely. So, and I'm sorry to interrupt, but you're spot on. And what I want to, like, what he would do is, like, you know, if, for instance, if your LPG cylinder is not working, the way that will be treated is as if it is a covert military operation, you know.
Correct.
As like the son will be told, Alpha to Bravo, Bravo to copy that, get screwdriver, roger that. Like there'll be a lot of this.
Yes. And I think most of these kind of fascist uncles thrive in cooperative housing settings. Right?
Aha, they play a big role in these resident welfare associations.
Correct. And I think they see themselves as the spear tip of their kind of a otherwise humane, progressive, and kind of slightly argument-ridden society. They see themselves as people of action. So in social contact with fascist uncles, you have to be careful about, you know, that the direction setting that they will do will seem very easy, right? But it has very little bearing with the reality of the real world. So let me give you an example, right? So if you go to fascist uncle and say that, you know, I'm facing a problem, my company hasn't given me the right kind of bonus, he look at you and say, this is easily solved. Who is your boss? Right? And they say, my boss is somebody called Narottam. Is he senior to you? I say, yes, he's senior to me. Do you know where he lives? And all of a sudden you find that the conversation takes sinister turn because, you know, he will say that you sort it out man to man, confront him, ask him that you need to be paid your dues, and if the chap doesn't listen, then, you know, bring in the heavies, right? So everything that fascist uncle will suggest, in the end, the root cause is going to be a violent act.
Right?
So, and in his mind, like, suppose there's a police challan, right? You know, why has this given you? If the policeman doesn't listen, and he'll always kind of give you this huge thing about, you know, how it's important to reason with people, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, we must tell these people that I didn't run over the beggar came in my way.
Ah.
If he's given the challan, you tell him the challan is not right. Yeah. And if he doesn't listen, at that point, rip up the challan and kick him in the balls. And as he's narrating that, you would think that, you know, fascist uncle has got a grip on reality. But the moment you move away from that vignette of you kicking a police officer in the balls, you suddenly realize the fascist uncle is kind of dead set. He's a complete disaster. And he only thrives in local housing associations and nowhere else.
Well, you know, you're absolutely spot on. And there's a certain kind of, I think, complete heartlessness. I've seen this, you know, like, homeless social problems, homelessness, poverty. They, like fascist uncle again, thinks that all of this is easily solved by like these completely like brutal measures. Like, actually knew people like this. I had a, literally, there was this guy who, a friend of mine in college, his uncle. Uncle told him that, you know, the way to solve homelessness is like, here's what you need to do. If you find a homeless guy, think about all his different relatives, and round up all of them, right? Or a beggar. So catch the beggar, round up every single person you can find who's connected with him. And he said, just exterminate all of them. That way they're all gone and nobody's left to mourn each other. So, you know, I hadn't read enough in college to be able to frame this in, you know, as fascist or whatever, but I was like horrified. I was like, this is an educated person. Like, how can you even think like this? But these guys do exist. That's the point. They're not.
No, absolutely. And I think just a segue on that, in the middle, there was like, Calcutta has always had a problem with hawkers, right? And hawkers
Hawkers are not allowed, should not be allowed on the roads. Yeah. They have to be living
there. Are things, some of the things that like a fascist uncle would be a naturally drawn to, like one-way enforcement near Gariyahat. Right? hawker encroachment on pavement. Like health and safety of Fuchkawala. Right? So, and each of these, and if you get drawn into any discussion about all of these things, he will have kind of an absolutist version that we need to create a compound exclusively for Panipuri Walas, where the water that will be provided will be filtered of the highest standard. The hygienic antecedents of the Fuchkawala delivery people will be checked. They will be licensed. Identity cards will be issued. Anybody found without identity cards will be expelled from the compound.
Without first warning. Repeat warning will be like death by firing squad.
Yes. And it'll all lead to an act of violence which is disproportionate to the context. Like, you know, the electricity bill is excess. You will go to see the electrical corporation. Go to the clerk. The fascist uncle's first sign is, please explain first, right? Because fascist uncle through his life has been accused of aap bahut jaldi aapka haath chal jata hai. So he has been critiqued by everybody, all and sundry, that you move too fast, man. Just slow down a bit. And he's aged now, so he takes great pains to say that, you know, aap log samajhne ka koshish kijiye. Pehle aap samjhaiye bande ko. Ye aap, you know, this is wrong. And if not, then, you know, to be shot at daylight. Right?
In broad daylight. You know, this daylight is, this in broad daylight is a phrase he loves. Because the idea is that you must send a message to everyone.
Khule aam.
Now, the third kind of uncle is the welfare leftist uncle. And the welfare leftist uncle, solution to everything is massive redistribution.
Yes.
And this is generally combined with a utter lack of knowledge of economics and of, I would say, even common sense. So to give you an example, like, you know, I have a vague memory of this, that, and I remember asking someone this. Maybe I was in like school or high school or college or something. So he was like, you know, these, so first, you know, welfare uncles, like, basic points are not off. Like, you know, there's an element of intuitive truth, right? Commonsensical truth to all these uncles, to much of what all the uncles say. So his point is that, you know, look at these, like, the Birlas and the Tatas and all, they made so much money and they don't give back to anyone. And okay, you know, boss, it's kind of true. Like, I remember in Calcutta, the neighborhood, where, you know, I think the Birlas and some other industrialists live, it had potholes, the road had potholes outside. And I remember my father or someone saying that, just as an observation, that look, I mean, these, you know, just from a philanthropic point of view, you can at least, like, you know, do up the road outside your house. Now, welfare uncle's point is, let's take all the money from the Birlas and, like, just give it to the poor. And so, you know, and then his idea is that is how you will get, like, economic parity. And you will get prosperity. So the question I asked one of these uncles was that, okay, you'll do this as a one-time thing. Let's assume, just for the sake of argument, the Birlas have like 5,000 crores. Okay. You take those 5,000 crores. India has a massive population. Just in Calcutta itself, the 5,000 crores it can improve the life of a lot of people. Having taken that money, Birla is also now in the company of beggars. Where is the next round of cash going to come from? So, you know, that is when uncle's uncledom comes out, that you don't know these things. You know, you don't understand these things. Let it be. So you are shut up. So that's my first point, which is that the practicalities of how this is going to sustain itself,
yeah,
that welfare and leftist uncle, they get very uneasy if you push them on that.
So welfare, that's a good point. Welfare uncle generally will have a background in, public sector undertaking, where he dabbled with trade unionism but didn't quite commit. Took early retirement and was partial to tutoring school kids in maths, right, for free.
No, yeah, he's an idealist.
Yeah, yeah. So he's in the thing of nation building and nation building ground up, right?
Yeah.
But one of the things that he's very partial to also is embassy parties, right? So you will find him in, and not like the major embassies, because he can't access them. Right?
Yugoslavia and usually the left of center ones, Tito.
Yeah. So he will, like, the Bulgarian special representative's best friend is throwing a tea party, and leftist uncle will be there. And leftist uncle, if you, in any problem that you talk to him, he will say that, look, this has to be a ground up solution. One person can't solve it. It has to be coming from everybody. Right? And he will inevitably hoping, like, you know, the solution is going to be NGOs who have been doing it for the last 70 years without any credit, right? And they need to be recognized and brought into mainstream. So if you're having a conversation with leftist uncle and you're saying that, leftist uncle, I'm in a difficult situation in my job, my boss hasn't given me a pay rise, his first is telling you, this is unfair. Obviously, this shouldn't happen. We need to do something about it. But this has to start ground up. Have you spoken to other people in the organization who haven't got a pay rise? Because you need to get together.
Organize
and take, there's an NGO called Apna Awaz Apna Pocket. You have to reach out to them and work with them, because they have created similar social movements using crowdfunding. So he will be, like, in tune with some, like, little touchstone words like crowdfunding, mm-hmm, you know, third sector, capacity building, right? Because he realizes this out and out Che Guevara number is not going to succeed. So everything that he'll ever recommend to you will have, like, the massive dependency on others, right? So if you come to him and say that, you know, uncle, mera fridge kharab ho gaya, right? He will say, have you spoken to your neighbor? Now, how is the neighbor going to help? Is not the uncle's concern. Uncle wants to make a personal problem. A problem shared is a problem halved, right? But it's not a problem solved, right?
Absolutely.
So uncle is in the, leftist uncle is in the game of sharing problems. Sabko baant do. Whether it's wealth or problems will be distributed. But whether it gets resolved or not, he will not have the wealth. And if you ask him what is his kind of success, he will say that even in Chhapra in 1982, I started a bicycle factory. And then you push him, was it a factory? He said, no, it was a workshop. Then he said, push him, was it a workshop? No, it was a shop. Right? So it'll kind of gradually unbundle, and you'll realize the only thing he's done out of this kind of community consultation led approach is set up a bicycle repair shop with two people, which closed as soon as he left.
Well, you know, you hit upon something very interesting, which is both about welfare uncle, leftist uncle, but also about all Indian uncles, which is that none of them actually give very practical advice. And that, I think, is the hallmark of an Indian uncle, that none of the gyan is actionable, actually. So the other thing that leftist uncle will do is, along with using this more sort of contemporary with it, you know, terminology, third way, micro-entrepreneurship, thought leadership now, etc., he'll also drop like iconic leftists very casually in conversation, but the references will again not be very useful. That, you know, so someone has come to him with this very specific problem, and it could be that it's an idealistic college student who just says, uncle, you know, I want to help the vendors who are outside our building, building society doesn't like them, and they've told, you know, the watchman to shoo them away, they've called the cops on them, but, you know, whether it's the cigarette wala, the pan wala, or the you know, chaatwala, whatever, like, they need a living as well. So there'll be something absurd, like, you know, beta Karl ne bola tha na 1865 mein factory workers ke baare mein, aur you know, Argentina mein Shea ne bola tha aur Naum ne bola tha for Chomsky. So there'll be a lot of this, like, random kind of, you know, name dropping, and there'll be these quotes that which have nothing to do with the solution at hand. So here is a college student who's idealistic but willing to do something, and maybe a few, you know, college kids or maybe some of the younger people are, you know, they want to hold the Bombay municipality accountable or something. So, which, you know, uncle will, like, say that, dekho, isko kehte hain, Chomsky jo kehta hai na, it is called manufacturing consent. And actually, manufacturing consent is not the concept that applies here. It has nothing to do with the situation. But all that leftist uncle is doing is he's reestablishing his cred. And then the advice comes at, like, some insane level of generality that, you see, this is actually the abstraction and reification of labor. And the question is that the fruits of the labor need to go back to the people better. So it's a very good point.
Anyway, look, we've talked at length about three of the uncles in the hope that we don't turn more. I mean, the starting point was that we don't want to turn into uncles, whichever type of uncle you see should come with a health warning. I think the catch up that we would always do is uncle, word of advice, do not advise.
Question not.
So that is where we'd like to leave this episode. But, you know, over to you, Rohit, for the last
one. That's it, man. I don't have anything to add to that. That word of advice, you shall not advise. You know, you shall not gyan. Okay, chalo boss.
Chalo, take care.
Thank you so much for listening to us. Rohit and Bunty would like to sign off. Please stay tuned. Follow us on India Explained on Twitter. Keep listening. Thank you for all your support.